Crisis communications is a complex science. There's a lot more to it than simply answering media or partner questions during a stressful situation. This series of edited discussions about crisis communication theory and practice is intended to help you refine your ability to manage, respond to, and ultimately survive a crisis. I'm Robert Johnson, your host for this conversation, presented by the Association of State and Territorial Health Officials and the National Public Health Information Coalition. Each module considers a different aspect of crisis communications management, as explained by an expert or experts in the field. These discussions are produced to summarize the written and visual materials that accompany each topic. In this module, we consider infodemics, helping you understand what they are and how best to manage them. Our experts today know a lot about this complicated topic. Elizabeth Wilhelm is a health communications specialist at the CDC and an infodemic management expert. Claire Wardle is a professor at Brown University. She's considered a foremost authority on health misinformation in the United States. The conversation is based on a presentation that you can find as part of this module. It includes a recording of the live presentation, complete with audience questions. Now, our discussion with Elizabeth Wilhelm and Claire Wardle. Let's begin with a definition. What is an infodemic? Elizabeth?
So the WHO definition of infodemic is an overwhelming amount of information, including mis- and disinformation accompanying acute emergencies or outbreaks.
Claire, what's your take?
I think why infodemic is such an interesting term is it's not just focused on the false information. It's an abundance of information, which actually makes it difficult for people to know what information to follow, who to trust. And I think that's a critical part of all of this. It's not just false information. It's like 3 million results on Google. What on earth do I do?
Now that we have our definition of an infodemic, Claire, would you agree that this problem is not a new one?
I mean, I think the focus on the infodemic has meant that some people have this suggestion that this is new. And certainly in the health misinformation space, anybody working around Ebola or HIV, you know, in the last 20 years would be like, yeah, we really struggled with the impact of false information and people being confused. And ultimately, there's been anti-vaccination information since the smallpox, you know, the early days of the smallpox vaccine. So we have to remember that this is a very particular moment, but we've never had a pandemic plus all of these social networks at the same time. So it's the confluence of those two things that have really made this feel very, very different.
Elizabeth, these misinformation campaigns have been around for so long because, unfortunately, they work. We can see that by the amount of damage that's been done by the effort focused on COVID-19 vaccines.
One statistic showed that early on, about 50% of Americans are unsure about popular vaccine misinformation, and a lot of it falls in the gray area because misperceptions can also affect people's confidence and knowledge and awareness as it relates to access. Another really concerning piece of misinformation that has been perpetuated both for COVID-19 vaccines and for other vaccines is that it affects fertility or that it is unsafe for pregnant people. This is really concerning. I just saw a report that in some parts of Latin America, the leading cause of maternal deaths has been COVID-19 recently. And to consider the fact that we have really, really low vaccination coverage among people who are pregnant for COVID-19 vaccination is really concerning.
And we haven't figured out how to measure their true impact?
So one of the challenges right now is that there are no well-established metrics or measures for the size of the infodemic or the impacts that it has or the cost. And those costs can be more than just dollar figures, right? So the cost to a variety of different things, whether it's social costs, such as misinformation that promotes stigma, misinformation that promotes racism, misinformation that promotes violence against health workers. We've seen all of these in the context of COVID-19 vaccines and for other vaccines as well.
Claire?
People think this is, oh, it's just memes on Instagram. Like, it hasn't really been taken seriously. Or we focus on the individual atoms of content. Should that YouTube video be taken down? Should Facebook label that photo? But it's really hard to step back and say, well, what does all of this mean? What are these narratives that are emerging about the way people trust their healthcare practitioner? How do people really think about alternative treatments? Or these big shifts we're just not able to see. And that's because it's hard to measure. But I think to Liz's point, in 5 years' time, 10 years' time, I think we're going to look back and be like, we had no idea what this was doing, yet it seemed frivolous. It seemed silly. Nobody could really pin it down. Policymakers didn't really know what they were doing, yet it's clearly having all of these very serious costs.
And that's a tough spot given how quickly a misinformation campaign can inflict damage compared with the time it takes to clean up the mess.
The internet is this revolutionary technology, and around 2016, 2017, everybody was looking for a quick fix. Surely if we just fix the Facebook algorithm, we'll get rid of this. We are moving through a 30 to 50 year transition as societies have to learn how to navigate polluted information environments. And I talk about this all the time. I have freckles. It's not like I can go outside and not recognize that sun is causing my skin harm. But I've learned to wear a big floppy hat and to put SPF 15 on. I have learned the skills to navigate pollution, light pollution. And that's what I talk about here, which is we're never going to get rid of this stuff. The question is, how do we build resilience in humans? Because this is a human problem. The psychology here is the bit that's damaging.
Elizabeth, you think we can learn from these negative campaigns and use those lessons to our advantage.
When you see something that's emotionally compelling, you're much more likely to share it. Unfortunately, we generally don't reach for that when we're developing messages from a public health perspective, but we should be able to find a middle ground where how can we do a better job of translating the science and telling the story about why you should get vaccinated, why you should continue masking in high transmission settings, why you should be doing all these things to mitigate transmission without resorting to factoids. There's ways to tell that story that are going to be more compelling and thoughtful and hopefully more effective.
And knowing the audiences, that's important also, correct?
Different populations have different relationships with technology, and we have to acknowledge that. Folks who are older, like my mom, uses Facebook in a very different way. My younger cousins do not use Facebook. They're on TikTok. And so those are very different ways of engaging with information online across the generations. And we need to have, I think, segmented strategies and approaches and recognizing how people interact online and their literacy in those spaces are very different.
Of course, once the misinformation is out there and rooted in people's minds, convincing the population otherwise can be a tricky situation. Right, Claire?
So as human beings, if you tell me, Robert, that I'm wrong, I'm like, who do you think you are? And I'm already resisting because of confirmation bias and other things. It's very difficult to convince me I'm wrong. As humans, we don't like to do that. However, if you're like, hey, Claire, let me tell you how other people are trying to manipulate you. It doesn't matter. You're not going into the topic per se. You're teaching me the tactics and the techniques. So that's the overall inoculation theory. Pre-bunking is an example of that. Whereas when you have a really clear sense of the types of rumors or misinformation that emerges, you can say, it is very likely you're going to see this.
You've talked about pre-bunking misinformation, essentially getting ahead of bad information before you get into a position of having to debunk the junk, so to speak. Elizabeth, how do we do that?
I think what we need to teach people is, well, how do you talk to your friends and family who share this with you and they think that they're sharing credible information with you? How do you talk them through that? And how do you help them reflect on what they're seeing? So you're helping slow down their ability or willingness to just share information that they haven't fact-checked or that they haven't looked at more closely.
Claire, I think you know what I'm going to say next. This is easier said than done.
This is not easy. This is the challenge of our time. But fundamentally, I think it comes back to trying to prevent harm. And ultimately, the work that I do with public health practitioners, they are the best at this in the world, because in public health, it's about working with communities, listening and having empathy. And so whether you're in Omaha, Nebraska, or you're in, you know, Rhode Island, it's about listening to people and listening to their concerns and fears.
Elizabeth, what's the takeaway?
You can't go wrong by listening to what communities' questions and concerns are and do what you can to address them and address them in ways that are appropriate to that community. So work with your faith-based leaders, work with local nonprofit organizations and community groups that represent folks who might not have access to healthcare or have the same trusted relationship with the local health department that other communities do. And so that's where you want to start.
You've been listening to one of six discussions about crisis communications available on demand via this platform. Make sure to listen to all of them. Each considers a different aspect of the science and art of messaging during an emergency. Also, don't forget to engage the other resources included in this training. That way, you'll be prepared when a crisis comes calling. On behalf of the Association of State and Territorial Health Officials and the National Public Health Information Coalition, I'm Robert Johnson. Thanks for listening, and be well.